Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are parking our time machine in 1997 in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, the goal drought continues despite having 31 shots against Norwich last Saturday. We did, however, stop the run of defeats, adding another point to the total against a doomed Norwich. Today, we make our first of two consecutive visits to North London to face an Arsenal side. They'll be smarting after going down to Palace on Monday and will be desperate to get their top four challenge back on track. We will be going there without Jakob Moda, who suffered an agonising ACL injury last Saturday that could seriously derail his hopes of being in Poland's World Cup squad in November. We wish you a speedy recovery, Kuba. And we have no goals or wins to talk about, but we have brought in a special guest. Earlier today, Alan caught up with Stuart Storer.
It's 25 years since we left the Goldstone. And when I say left, turfed out, there was all sorts of shenanigans going on in the early 90s, EGMs. And even when the ground was sold, we weren't told properly. There had to be protests, pitch invasions. There was all sorts of things going on. But all the while, the football had to continue. Players were going to be up against it. They saw what was going on. The toxic nature of what happened is now very much the stuff of legend. We call it the war years. And one of the players slap bang in the middle of that was Stuart Storer. And I'm delighted to say that from the very plush settings of Bedworth United, Stuart Storer joins me now. Stuart, 25 years on. Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you very much. 25 years. Wow, where's that time gone, hey?
It was almost like a quarter of a century. Who knew? But are you well? Yeah, I mean, I'm here sort of sitting across it from on Zoom looking at you. How are you feeling? What's occurring? What are you doing these days?
Yeah, so I'm manager of Bedworth United Football Club. We're in step four of the pyramid, non-league pyramid. Bedworth's just outside Coventry. Mm-hmm. So generally, I'll run the football club, manage it. And we've got academy set up here as well. So bringing young players through the system and getting into the first team.
Fantastic. And how's that going for you?
Yeah, we're about mid-table security at the moment. So we were close to the playoffs at one point and we've just died away. But we're building the club up slowly. The infrastructure's in place. The people are in place. The next thing is to get my job going properly and get us up the tables.
Yeah, I mean, and how, you know, that's the outline for Bedworth, but how is it for you? How do you find a job like this?
Yeah, I like giving back, actually. Football gave me a lot of good times, a lot of good memories, a lot of bad memories as well. But yes, I like giving back, and that's a big part of it for me as well, the intrinsic reward.
I mean, it's interesting you say that. I mean, it is a symbiotic relationship between the fans and the players, and the ringer that the fans go through, I'd imagine, is pretty much, well, as a player or a manager or even as a supporter, the ringer that you go through. So, I mean, what, you know, in your current role, is that the same thing you go from when you've got very little direct influence of what's going on in the game, that you know, your heart is still going as mad as any fans would be?
Yeah, it's crazy, really. You care about it so much. You want everybody to do well. But like you said, there's only a small portion of that you can do during the 90 minutes. So, yeah, I generally pace up and down like a lion. I drink lots of water and try and keep my heart rate down because although it's still non-league, there's so many people that care about this football club and it rests on your shoulders to a certain extent.
Absolutely. Did you do the kick the water bottle thing?
No, if I kick anything now, I'll probably pull a hamstring or something. So I best leave the kicking to the young'uns.
Okay, well, let's go back that quarter of a century. I mean, you say where's the time gone? And, you know, I suppose probably for an Albion fan, it's, you know, of a given vintage. It's something that's still quite raw. And it's, you know, from our rarefied lofty position here up in the Premier League nowadays, it's easy to look back on and say, you know, well, you know, this is what happens when you invest millions. But, you know, there were plenty of us, thousands of us, that had to live through that time of actually basically having to pull out all the stops to save the club. But as you as a player, tell us how you came to come to Albion in the first place.
Well, I was at Exeter under Alan Ball and then Terry Cooper. Exeter went through a similar situation where They were going to go into receivership. So at the end of the day, they sold all their players or got rid of the players, and they was just left me with the youth team. And I was getting really frustrated. Brighton came in for me about 3 months earlier and showed an interest, and it fell down because the receivers were wanting too much money for me. And it wasn't really until I refused to play for Exeter that that was the last stand, because I was being used as a scapegoat, I felt, by being the only senior player playing with the youth team. I got touted around a bit, and then Brighton did come back in for me, and that's how I came about coming to Brighton under Liam Brady. I joined there just as sort of Steve Foster was finishing off.
Right.
So we had people like Dean Wilkins there. We had people like Chappers, Ian Chapman. Kerry Mayo was just probably a 16-year-old.
Also, his balls had just dropped, hadn't they?
And his voice. Yeah.
Peter Smith there, would you have had? And
Smith, yeah.
Denny just, Mundy.
Yeah, Denny Mundy. Yeah, so it was that sort of time. I was probably a little bit before Peter Smith, as in joined before him.
Right.
But yeah, we had a group of players there. We was in the old third division, as it was. And just I joined, and we just managed to stay up that year.
So when you first met your new teammates, your new work colleagues, as it were, I mean, did you feel a difference? Was there a sense of relief of being able to get out of Exeter, or was there sort of something bittersweet about leaving Devon?
I wanted to get out. I was unhappy at the situation. Again, no disrespect to the youth team there, but I was playing with the youth team. And they'd sold all their assets or got rid of the assets, and I was just left there. So I was quite looking forward for a fresh start, a new beginning, especially with such a legend as Liam Brady as well.
Well, quite. I mean, you probably had an inkling that, you know, Brighton and Hove Albion was this, you know, middling to bottom third division side whose star had fallen, you know, its image was tarnished and it wasn't doing great things. But, you know, did you sort of still feel that moving to from Exeter to Brighton was a bit of a step up?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, Exeter managed to survive, but for the purposes of my career, I had to get away because it was doing me no good mentally as well. You know, we talk about mental health in these days. I could feel myself drowning there simply, and I needed to have a fresh start somewhere else and perk myself up and get my career back on track.
Sure. So tell us about your first training day. I mean, we've spoken to many, many Albion players on their first, you know, from those that joined in the mid 70s to those that joined, you know, sort of in the 21st century. Tell us about the culture and what it was like amongst the players when you joined.
Yeah, so first training session was at Falmer up at the university.
Warwick Field, yeah?
Yeah. So pulled up there, very excited, meeting my new teammates and things like that. We did the first training session, and then unfortunately, literally on the last shooting session, I ripped my thigh. Ah. And it was like, for crying out loud. Don't want to be injured, but I've injured myself. So I was really frustrated at the fact that signed for a new club, was really looking forward to getting going, and all of a sudden, bang, things were sort of put on hold. So I was quite frustrated. The lads were brilliant. They were taking the mick like they do, you know. And
by this at this time, you hadn't heard of Malcolm Stewart.
Malcolm became a very good friend within the first 3 months I was there, because I was really struggling. But me and Malcolm got on really well. Top man. I was gutted, absolutely gutted. I think we hadn't had a signing for a long time.
Yeah.
And I had to come along and got injured on my first training session. So I don't think I enamoured myself to the fans straight away, did I?
Let's put it this way. Let's blame the training regime that you had at Exeter. Let's put it that way.
That's a good shout, yeah.
Yeah, you can put it down to that, you know. But let's talk about the players in a minute. But you know, Malcolm's been on the show a couple of times. He's a man of many stories. I've asked him to write his biography, but I think too many players would want to veto it. So give us your lowdown about the most terrifying man in Sussex.
Just very, very friendly, very knowledgeable. I've got a few stories as well, but I'd probably veto him. So I'd best be careful what I say as well. But very welcoming, charming man. And again, always listening to you, always on your side. Just top man.
Absolutely. So how long did it take for him to repair you?
Yeah, well, I got to a point where I was stopping in the Excelsior Hotel on the seafront. Yep. So I could sort myself out somewhere to live. The food there was great. Beer there was good as well. And I sort of managed to put on a good stone and a half.
And Liam must have gone loopy.
Liam didn't. He was saying things like, all he told me, you was a good lad and look at the state of you and things like that. And I said, I'm a good lad, but I'm not fit, am I? So I just want to play football. But it got to a point with two games left at the end of the season, remembering I signed just before deadline day, that Liam sort of said, look, we've just got to get you out on the field and just do what you can. So I think the first game I just couldn't get involved at all. And we ended up playing Birmingham in the last day of the season at St Andrews. And I played in that game. So that was sort of my debut game after waiting a long time. Obviously, the fans and people got to see me in a Brighton shirt.
Yeah, and I'm going, tell us about your debut.
Birmingham, one of my old clubs. Literally, I think they needed a result. And we nearly took it off, and they scored in the last minute, unfortunately. But the goal was a cracking goal. They all are from me, aren't they? Ian Chapman went down the left wing like he did, put a great ball into the far post. I managed just to get my foot on it on the volley, a side foot at a very narrow angle, went straight across the keeper and nestled just inside the post.
Crikey, I was there for that. And that was the one. Oh, that one actually really drove us around the twist, because I think we were originally given 1,500 tickets, and Birmingham, and who was the chief executive in those days? Karen Brady. She decided arbitrarily that she was only going to give us 150 because Birmingham were going to fill the place out. They took it to the Football League Tribune and said, OK, let's settle on 500. There were 7,000 empty seats in the end.
Yeah.
And one, the other thing, now we couldn't get, there's me and my mate Charlie, we couldn't get away tickets. So we thought we'd very carefully and quietly and sit on our hands and sit in the home end. And that's an eye-opener. And yes, I think Birmingham went something like 2-0 up, and then we pulled it back to 3-2 up. Something tells me that there was an overhead kick from one of our goals, wasn't there?
Stuart Mundy. I think Stuart Mundy scored. He pulls out some great goals, did Stuart?
I think
it was him, actually. I could be mistaken.
I think it was Stuart Mundy. I think you're right. I think it was Stuart Mundy. But the hilarious thing about this, and this is a bit of perspective for you, was obviously Birmingham's, you know, took the lead. Now, I could be wrong about the scoring sequence, but the main thing I remember was the ongoing battle that Ricky Otto had with Peter Smith. And Ricky Otto was kind of seen as this slight talisman for Birmingham, and Peter Smith basically stuck him in his pocket. That's from our memory, and the Birmingham fans were just going nuclear at Ricky Otto. But Smudge had a brilliant game that day. I mean, is that your memory of it? Bit hazy?
Well, my memory is obviously scoring that goal. That's all that matters to me.
The rest of the touches don't count.
And actually, playing part, that's my first game, and waiting so long, you know, it was, I think it was relief from Liam as well, that he eventually got me on the pitch, relief from me that I'd managed to play a bit of a game. Mm-hmm. And then it was all about resetting myself for the season after.
So how did you go about doing that, given that obviously you're, as we've probably worked out, your regime at Exeter was going to be different for your regime at Brighton. So how did you go about through that pre-season? Were you given sort of plans? I mean, were they advanced enough to give you sort of nutrition plans and exercise plans? Or was it a case of, right, sort yourself out?
But I think it was a bit of sort yourself out. The old weighing scales usually came out first day, so you didn't want to be overweight. So I can't remember the fine, but there was a fine if you was overweight. And like I said to you, I was overweight, so I needed to do something. But I was just happy I could sort of run around and get that weight off. So played a lot of tennis, a lot of squash, went for quite a lot of runs. Nothing sort of specific. Looked after my diet and generally got my weight down and felt a lot more confident in myself. So when we started pre-season, I was like really up for it.
That's one of those kind of funny things, and fans can be cruel at times, and I'm least one to talk about it these days. But, there's certain players that you do consider sort of do carry some timber. But from memory, I don't really recall you being sort of one of the game's stockier players or one of the chubbier players. So, and maybe stripes, make you have that slimming effect. But I don't really recall you sort of being a bit of a chunky player.
I could do with some stripes, some gear now that you're talking like that. But no, I never was. I was always lean, fortunately. But I think because they stuck me in the Excelsior with that menu, with that bar.
The temptations.
It was more like over excessive stuff on my part. But I soon got it off. And like I say, I was looking forward to the new season.
So when you did actually sort of get yourself pitched and settled, where did you end up living?
Patcham. So I lived in Patcham. So I rented a place out there, quite close to Malcolm Stewart, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But then again, he gets everywhere in Brighton, doesn't he?
He has done, yeah.
But I stayed there for four and a half years. So it was a good time.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's the stuff on the pitch. Now, I think that probably what you're talking about here is we're about to go into the 95-96 season. And I think probably at the end of that, in between the 95 and 96 seasons, the story broke that the Goldstone was being sold. And when I say the story broke, it wasn't an announcement by the club. They very much wanted to keep it quiet. And the story itself is legend. There's been books written about it. We've had interviews with people from the council, from the club, from the various interested parties who told their story. And it's not a particularly pleasant tale from pretty much anyone's point of view. The club wanted to put in planning permission, a retail park, just in order to increase the value of the land so they could borrow against it. The club had owned the land since 1902. And then came Bill Archer, who took this particular planning permission, tore straight through the gentleman's agreement that the Albion and Hove Borough Council then had, and said, well, I'm not party to this. If we've got planning permission, then let's build on it. These, quote, southern softies won't do anything to stop us. And so started the war years. Do you recall the start of this story, or was it something that kind of was off the radar for a long time?
Yeah, as a player, you sort of hear rumours, but until anything's sort of set in stone, you just go along with trying to do your job. So at the end of the day, the rumours were in the background, but I don't really think we thought it would come to any fruition. But how wrong were we? Hey.
But, I mean, were you actually given an announcement? Did someone come down to the training ground and said, OK, lads, this is what's happening? Or did it? Because with the fans, we had to eke it out of them. And, in fact, in the first, when the Argus broke the story, the club flatly denied it.
I can't remember fully, but I still can't remember anyone telling us that news. So it probably came through whispers.
Yeah, isn't that an appalling way to actually just treat, never mind treat the fans, but treat the staff as well?
Well, the whole community is very, very disrespectful. Yeah.
Yeah. So when the whispers started, is it something you just put on the back burner? Did you, or, did it affect your thinking, your approach, your philosophy in any way?
I don't think in the early days, like I said, I think until something becomes solid or you see things happening that are irregular or not right or out of order, that you carry on and try and do the best you can. And try not to let outside influences affect you. But obviously they did.
Yeah, so I guess probably the first real sort of physical notion of this, I mean, there was the chants going, what's going on? There's, you've got Belotti writing his programme notes saying, well, telling fans to stop whining. Well, well done on the PR stakes there, mate. But there was, you know, the first days, there was a mini pitch invasion. It was at half time, you know. I think I couldn't tell you the game. I mean, I'd have to go and look up the excellent Builder Bonfire to tell you which game it was. It was early in the season.
Yeah.
And I think Liam Brady came out and placated the fans, and they left the pitch for him, which I understand infuriated David Belotti. So, again, you know, for the fact there was the fury from the fans, could you actually... Did you have any inklings of the board's attitude towards everyone?
Well, things like that started to creep in, and then you begin to think, well, what the hell is going on? You've got the manager still trying to stick up for the club, which was fantastic. He was trying to do a professional job, Liam. But I don't think it was long after that Liam resigned and couldn't stand it anymore after battle after battle after battle. You know, and his professionalism got questioned. And obviously, the board probably won that battle in respect of they've got rid of Liam.
Well, this is it. I mean, here we are, Liam Brady, one of the most sort of gifted footballers of his era. For those who've never seen him play, I mean, as much as he's a Brighton hero, you just go back through the archives and watch him play in Match of the Day. I mean, it's all going to be there on YouTube. See him playing for Arsenal and Sampdoria and Ireland and... You know, like I say, one of the most cultured, gifted footballers. And here, I think, you know, I think it's because he had actually moved down here. But, you know, we were, you know, it was gifted that we had him as a manager, right? You know, it's not quite up there with Cluffy because he never really cut it as a manager. But, you know, here we are with one of the sort of major names from world football being treated like an office boy by this horrible Weasley... Nothing. Sorry, I'm trying not to swear here, Stuart, and I'm remembering this 25 years on. You were living this. You know, and I say, appreciate you had to have an air of professionalism, but surely somewhere down the line you think, this is there's something wrong here, something fundamentally wrong.
Definitely. Like, I've been watching quite a few of the big match revisited on TV of late, and Liam pops up all the time. Alan Ball as well, another ex-manager. Hmm. They pop up, and the ability that them players had and the reputation that they built was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And yet you've got someone like Belotti, a sort of a nobody, belittling such a great player and well thought of person within football. It was absolutely ridiculous, taking on no sort of information, no knowledge that Liam had, and look at the vast amount of knowledge he had, and just running or doing what they wanted to do with our football club. Absolutely ridiculous.
Did you know that David Belotti was originally an Exeter City fan?
Yeah, he was probably took Exeter and dive as well.
In administration.
Did he follow me by any chance?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, that kind of trouble just follows you around, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But you know, those 2 years, I mean, like I say, they've been well documented, and I've got Builder Bonfire to my side here, and it's just sometimes, you know, we don't want to get forever nostalgic, although we are at the moment, you know, but... and it's just nice to dip in and out, because I think it's a story that must be told. And as time went on, certainly that 95-96 season, there was a lot of protests. And the season itself on the pitch, you know, we had an appreciation as fans that it was having an effect on the players. And I think that somewhere down the line that the fans needed to talk to the players to work out what the effect was. And the players, I think, probably wouldn't have minded having a word with the fans and saying, look, you know, can you at least try and get behind us? So were there these axes of conversation that had to bypass the club that happened between players and fans? Is there anything that you're aware of that happened in those days?
You know, we had quite a lot of players that were quite approachable. And when we'd be in and around Brighton, fans would come up and ask us questions. So I think we had that relationship, and as obviously people talk to people, I think word got around. I do remember that me, Steve Foster, and a couple of other players went in to see Belotti as soon as Liam left. as if to say, what's going on? What, you know, what's happening? We need some clarification. We need to get on some firm ground of what is happening so we can understand, so we can kick on, or, you know, or not, as it were.
Yeah.
And again, like mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed a lot of manure.
So again, it was a case of you weren't actually told that Liam had been fired or had resigned. I think he was fired, but you hadn't actually been told that. Again, you had to hear it through other sources. Yeah.
Well, it was when Liam left, I think the alarm bells then sort of rang massively. You know that if Liam's left, he's our leader, great player, great manager. There's something wrong. There's something massively wrong. And then you've got all the rumours to back that up with the Argus, with all their stories. And all we wanted to do as a group of players is try and find out what was happening. So, you know, that was where we were at that point.
That's where that's just some stability to your playing side, just to know what's... Even if you didn't like it, you just wanted to know what's going on.
Just tell us the truth and we'll deal with it. You know,
good luck with that.
yeah, you know.
As fans... I think that it was actually, we realised quite quickly that the main thing we wanted to do was get Archie Bellotti and Stanley out of the club, even though at the time we didn't really have a plan B. We just wanted them out of the club. And then this other character came along in the background, that a consortium that Liam Brady had put together. Now, we'll come to that presently. But on the pitch, you know, it was almost going to be an air of inevitability because of the way that the club was going. It had a greater probability than most other clubs. Now, for you, from a professional point of view, that must be very painful.
Yeah. I think me probably having the experience at Exeter made me probably a little bit more aware of what was going on as well, you know, with the turmoil. I felt there's a lot of players at the club didn't deal with that very well. I can't say I dealt with it brilliantly, but obviously I had a bit more experience of a club in crisis, as it were. So for me, it was, what can we do? Because you feel helpless as players. And the fans obviously felt exactly the same, helpless, because people are taking our club down the wrong path. And how can we stop this? So it was, you know, really, really frustrating for everybody involved.
Because I think certainly from a fan's point of view, our attitude was, well, so long as we've got a club to fight for, the difference between the third and fourth division, we're not honestly that bothered. Now, as a player, you just think, actually, that's a really hurtful thing to say, because you really care about what division you're going to be in. And our attitude is, actually, we've got a bigger priority right now. And that is getting rid of this heinous ball. So, I mean, did you notice a kind of a rift in that sense between, you know, what the fans were after, the priority that the fans were after, and what you as professional players would have been after?
Well, as a professional, you want to win games of football. And you don't want to be associated with relegation or losing. It, you know, it dents your ego, it dents your pride. Hmm. But on the other side, if you can see a club going out of business, you don't want them going out of business, you want them to remain. So the bigger picture was probably always the case, but while you was in the time and the moment, you still had your professional ego and pride not to be relegated and not to be associated with losing.
Absolutely. So let's get towards the end of the 95-96 season. I mean, relegation is all but a certainty. Sorry to sort of labour that point there.
Yeah.
But then it comes the last home game of the season and we're playing against York City. And we, at that moment, it was due to be the Albion's last ever game at the Goldstone. History will obviously tell you we've got an extra season, but at the time, going into that last game of the season, we didn't know as to whether the club was going to have a future at that ground at all. And in fact, there was still no solid plan as to where we were going to go. So do you have a recollection, and we're talking 26 years ago now, do you have any recollection of the build-up to that home game against York City, notwithstanding what happened after whatever it was, 12 minutes or something?
Yeah, just just pure uncertainty, and you're going into work not knowing what's going to happen next, the uncertainty of where we was going to go, pure uncertainty, and obviously having that extra year at the Goldstone was massively helpful for the football club. And probably a stay of execution if you look at it in that sort of way.
Well, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that there was a misunderstanding, and the pitch invasion, as such as it was, which was planned, was supposed to be 55 minutes, not 15 minutes. But saved time, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It like bought us a bit of time, didn't it? Let's say that, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, 40 minutes of not risking getting injured, but... I mean, did you have an inkling as to anything that was going on? Were you guys tip the wink or anything?
No, completely. Like I said before, like mushrooms, and that uncertainty, that unstableness at the football club was so unhelpful to us as players, but obviously as the whole community, it was terrible. Really, it was terrible.
And I always recall a friend of mine who was actually, sadly for him, a work colleague of Bellotti at East Sussex County Council. And he took David Bellotti took his 18-year-old son to a game, you know, in those last days, where of which point he's got 10,000 fans singing at him that basically his father likes to play with himself a lot. You know, that's a lovely thing that you want to do for your lad. But when it came to the crossbars being broken, admittedly an act of wanton vandalism, but it got the headlines, and I think ultimately history has shown that for the right reasons. What did you guys, did you actually sort of think about a bigger picture as to what was going on here on that day?
Oh, definitely, yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. The future of the football club, and again, just the front of Bellotti was scary. Talk about having the skin of a rhino. He had a skin of a diplodocus. You know, he would just add that front where he had no sort of feelings. He had no connection. It was like a business transaction all the way along, where he did not give a flying monkeys.
Yeah.
You know, it was all about, I need to do my job and I will stand here and be sort of obnoxious as I can, sort of rack off as many people as I can and just stay there. And like you say, to put your son in a situation like that, what is going through that man's head? Madness, isn't it?
Don't try and ask me to reason with the unreasonable issue, Stuart. Yeah. I have no idea.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's going
How much does he hate his son?
Yes. Yeah, he must do, yeah.
Because the papers called it, you know, I think obviously Euro 96 was coming up and the papers sort of like, you know, oh, hooliganism is back.
Yeah.
But I think that Liam Brady, by now ex-manager, if my memory serves correct, is legendarily called it a different kind of riot.
Definitely, it is a different kind of riot. Obviously, riots and wars are started because people are unhappy. We were unhappy for the right reasons.
Yeah.
We wanted to cause chaos because we had no say. We had no information. We had nothing. So therefore, you know, people turn, don't they?
And we'll pause it there because you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And as ever, we're brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Al, we have a beautiful shirt of the week this week, with a lovely blue and white stripe number for you.
Well, okay. AD, do you want to describe it for us then?
Well, it's blue and white stripes. And it's sponsored by Hyundai. It has a...
I was joking, but okay.
It's made by Joma. It's actually a really, really lovely...
It is a nice blue and white striped shirt, actually. But the issue I've got is the extent to which the badge has been photoshopped. That's my main sort of thing here. It's shield... A badge is shield-shaped, but poking out the top of the shield is a kind of an old-style leather football. There's a blue and white stripe part of the shield, and what looks like, and this is where things get a bit weird, a kind of castle or brick castle or fort or something with a couple of palm trees at the top of it, either in the sea or on some clouds. Now, I don't know if that's got any clue to the team whatsoever, but it's
have a guess.
Sorry?
Have a guess.
Well, it's purely the palm trees that would actually... Hang on, Phil's just been to Cyprus, hasn't he? I'm going to guess... I cannot remember the name of them, but the team that Calde played for in Cyprus...
No, it's not.
Okay, in that case, whatever it is, I'm going to guess something Cypriot. Above and beyond that, not a clue.
It's not. This is the 2015 to 2016 home shirt of Spanish side Atletico Barreras, who are based in Palma on the island of Mallorca. The team was formed... The team was formed in 1920 and home is a 6,000 capacity Estadio Baler. They play in the Primera División RFEF, which is the third level of football in Spain. The league has approximately 40 teams in it and is divided into two sections with a northwest-southeast split. At the end of the season, the top teams from each division are promoted to the Segunda, and the runners-up have to play in a playoff to settle the third promotion spot. The club's glory days were in the early 50s and then the early 60s when they spent four seasons in the Segunda, which is the second division in Spain. Other than that, they spent their entire history, the rest of their history in the third and fourth tiers of Spanish football, as well as some time in the regional Balearic leagues. A current link to the UK is midfielder Samuel Shashua, who was born in West London and played for Spurs in their youth team between 2015 and 18 before signing a professional contract. He was loaned to Atletico Baleares in 2018 before signing for Tenerife in 2019 and then for Baleares again in 2020. His brother Armando also plays for the side. Whilst looking for some Albion links, I came across Jose Escuerdo, who played 29 times for Atletico Baleares between 2011 and 2012. But it turns out it was someone else with the same name.
That's a bit...
That's a bit
selfish, isn't it?
To but of course.
Ahead of an Albion player.
But we know, but Phil wasn't going to be beaten on this, and he did find a bona fide Albion link with striker Florin Andoni, who spent a season with Atletico Baleares in 2013 to 2014, playing 34 league games, scoring 12 times whilst on loan from Villarreal. So thank you for that, Phil. You can, of course, see that and hundreds of thousands of others over on oldfootballshirts.com. Our quick notice board before we get back to Stuart's story.
Notice board, certainly, yes. Just a reminder that the Renf games take place this year. 29th of April at Croydon is the first leg, the Croydon FC. So, and then the second leg, 27th of May at Sussex FAHQ, Cobble Road, Lancing. Very exciting time to be able to do this. This is superb. So if you are in the vicinity, please do get involved. Additionally, it's we're hosting a 25th anniversary of Leaving the Goldstone quiz, 6th of May at Dick's Bar. So if you think you know or remember your history of the Albion since 1997, then do pop along. It's £15 per person. It includes free pie and pint. And all the proceeds get split between Albion Community and the Ukrainian Disaster Emergency Committee. Please come along. Teams of up to six are available. And if you want to take part, please do actually email me rather than just turn up as you would do with a Renf quiz. If you do want to take part, please email goldstone25quiz@gmail.com. That's goldstone25quiz@gmail.com. And be great to see you there. Do take part.
Okay. And let's get back to Stuart Storer.
So let's just move on to the next season. And this is where things start kind of heating up and speeding up. Now, we're now in the fourth division for the first time since 1965. Things aren't looking good. We've managed to get our stay of execution. Belotti has BS'd his way through it, saying, "Oh, you know, we've pulled this out at the last minute." Archer and Stanley are getting rich on the back of the interest that they've on the loans that they've put into the club. It's all a big money making wheeze for them. Archer is still saying that, you know, what the fans going to do about it, and there's this new character in town, a consortium put together by Liam Brady. still for me a seriously underrated hero of all this. I mean, don't get me wrong, Dick Knight, Martin Perry, Bob Pinnock, heroes all, but still Liam Brady. It's actually very interesting that he's done so few interviews on this subject. But again, as players, as you go into the season and you realise the politics of the background, do you actually get, again, a notion of what's going on around you? Or is it, again, just sort of drip-fed?
Yeah, drip-fed. Not much positive news. Everything drip-fed, you know, to us. So it's negativity after negativity, which is very difficult. I think quite a few players left in that summer as well. I'm not sure when Jimmy Case took over, but I know Jimmy was in charge at the beginning of that season at some point.
Yeah, I lose count.
It's so Jimmy, and again another hero.
Again, got to the cup final, basically.
But you know, with his playing record and the sort of character he is, a very dogged, determined character. Came up against what Liam probably came up against. And, you know, with the same result at the end of the day, you know, that one, he couldn't do anything himself to help us through.
Well, I was about to say, I mean, Jimmy Case had a certain standing in football, and as much as certainly he was part of a European dominating Liverpool side. And even then, after he left Liverpool, he went on to Brighton and Southampton and still carried on his career and ended up finishing with a red card at the age of 62, you know, sent off for being deaf, basically. And yeah, again, an underrated character in Brighton's history, in my opinion. But probably didn't have the same clout that Liam Brady had within football. And, you know, and possibly an easier person for Bellotti to, and let's call Bellotti for what he is, an out-and-out bully.
Yeah.
For him to bully, you know, into submission.
Yeah, it's a pity we couldn't have just locked Liam and Bellotti in a, Jimmy and Bellotti in a room and let Jimmy have a few tackles on him.
So, you know, the things were moving on and eventually, you know, Jimmy was sacked and Steve Gritt was eventually brought in and he must, I mean, surely even you players would have said, listen, mate, this is a toxic job.
It's like, but then you probably look at it and he's seen it as an opportunity. You know, if he does well in this job, him and Jeff would sort of cement their names around the football community. So there's two ways of looking at it. But
wow,
who would want this job? You know, who would want this poison chalice? You know, Liam struggled, Jimmy struggled.
Maybe
they just got too wound up in all the politics of it all and lost a little bit of sight on the football side because they cared so much.
Beginning of December 96, there's a 16-year-old Plymouth fan sitting in his pyjamas at his dad's computer, outraged that the club's been fined 2 points and that the FA wouldn't do this to Manchester United, and makes a suggestion that other fans from football clubs around the country should come with their home shirts on and support the Albion's cause. And hence the Colonel, the great idea for Fans United was born. For you, I'd imagine just a day of a foggy game against Hartlepool United, for us a red letter day, or was it something more important for you?
Well, am I right in thinking we won that 5-0? Yeah, I'll make sure I get the right game. So, what a day that was. Yes, and I think probably a big turning point. We've had so much negativity and so much lies fed to us that all these people coming together created such a good atmosphere in the Goldstone. It was like, wow. I remember going to do the warm-up and the place being very full and an atmosphere and a buzz around the ground. And it was like, wow, where's this been? This has been missing for 2 years. Yeah, like, wow, this is what football's about. This is what you enjoy playing in front of, you know? And it was almost like it had been brought back to football and gone away from the politics of the football club. This was what it was about. And probably that was when the green shoots started to poke through. Steve Gritt come in and people pulling together.
Yes. I mean, you realise that we never lost the game at the Goldstone after that.
I know, it was like, but we'd never won away though, did we?
Well.
Yeah, so it was almost like catch up, drop behind.
But, yeah.
You know, credit to everybody. You know, we was always looking towards that last day. And if we had a chance on that last day, let's give it a go, you know?
Absolutely. So what do you remember of Craig Maskell's hat-trick?
Yes, Craig, cultured finisher, very cool finisher. Can't remember the goals, but he always seemed to have the drop the shoulder onto the right foot and curl it sort of over the keeper into the top corner. Did it numerous times in games, numerous times in training. Yeah. So I'm guessing there was probably one of them in there.
I've got a feeling that actually a combined all three goals were probably didn't come to more than about 10 yards in that particular day.
Yeah.
So, at the time, did you realise it was going to be something special that day?
No, not really. And I think probably all the background stuff, you don't realise. It wasn't until I walked out for the warm-up, it was like, wow, yeah, I like this. This is good. Positivity, yeah.
So you knew it was going to be fans united, but you didn't realise what it was going to mean?
No, not at all. Again, you didn't realise how big that was. It was just an idea, like you said, from a young lad, grown, and then all of a sudden, I'm walking out onto a pitch. Yeah, it's been in the Argus, Fans United and things like that. Until I walked out, I didn't realise the enormity of it.
Sure. And I think until the day itself, and let's face it, it's like Bellotti had made a pact with Satan himself. It was a really foggy day, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, if I remember rightly, yes.
Yeah, and I think it was...
Tried to scupper that.
Yeah, borderline, it was going to get called off, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the great scheme of things, it could have been a plague of locusts as long as the game went ahead and we won 5-0. I'd have been more than happy.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on. You know, we're climbing, getting ever closer to those teams, you know, in 23rd place. And we get to probably one of the most emotional days in any Brighton supporting players, any Brighton supporters history. Is the last ever game at the Goldstone, 26th of April, 1997. Even though you're being a professional, you know this is a big day coming up, don't you?
Yeah, but again, we wanted to make sure we won that game to give us an opportunity to one, to stay up, and two, to have a throw of the dice on the last game.
Yeah.
So...
Is that basically what you're aiming towards? As the games are going on, you just want to say, come last day of the season, we want to be in with a reasonable shout. Was that your target?
Jeff Wood ran that down our throats. Last day of the season, that's when it matters. Yeah, we've lost away at Carlisle. Don't worry. Last day of the season, that's what matters. That's what will define you. So Jeff was brilliant like that, ramming it down our throats. When we'd lost, to stay positive. When we'd won, to again look at target setting and look to where we wanted to get to achieve our goal. So going into that last match, we knew we had to win. It was made all the special that the atmosphere was fantastic. There's so many people there.
Yeah.
And it made it a big spectacle, yes. But again, being truthful as a player, it was about making sure we get this job done. And we were that focused.
You had a big part in it, though, didn't you?
Just a little bit, yeah.
Go on, tell our listener.
It was just a game.
And don't tell me you haven't watched the goal back ever.
Not ever. It gets sort of put on quite a bit, and I watch it. It's nice that I'm obviously associated with it. But generally, it was a game against Doncaster, the last ever game at the Goldstone. Goldstone was absolutely chocker. I remember driving to the game. Well, I was driven to the game by my wife. And it's just blue and white everywhere, you know.
How were the nerves on approach to the Goldstone?
It just gave me a buzz. I wasn't nervous. It gave me a right buzz. I was thinking, wow, look at all these people coming out to see us, you know. We need to win. And back in sort of the dark days, the war years, as you call them, where we was warring all the time. Belotti had been forgotten about. Dick Knight was on the horizon.
Yeah.
Everything was buzzing. And again, I just felt, I am so looking forward to this game. Whereas other games was like, oh, what's going on here? What am I doing here? Do you know? So the whole sort of culture had changed, that we had a chance. We still had that Jeff Wood philosophy. We can get to that last game.
Beautiful weather, wasn't it?
Oh, it was glorious. It was glorious. Yeah. And again, so pumped up for the game, doing the warm-up, going through my routine, trying to focus. And then, obviously, once the game started, it was full of emotion, wasn't it? You know, with Bairdy and Darren Moore being sent off and having that fracas. I think I went to centre forward then for the rest of that half, but had very little impact up there, and we had to sort of rejig the team a little bit at half time so we could get a bit of stability back.
Sure. So, in your words, talk us through the winning goal.
Well, it was a corner from Jeff Minton. Jeff swung one across to the far post about 10 yards out. Oh, no, or didn't it? See, I don't watch it very often. There you go. So I think initially it came close to me and it came off the bar. Then Mark Morris put it back across. Craig Maskell took the keeper out for me so I couldn't miss. And I thought I was a lot further out than I was. But I
think you were fully... I was about to say, you're fully 25 inches away.
See, it's getting shorter every time. But yeah, fortunately, I just kept my cool and managed to get a good connection on it.
I mean, any given player, any professional player will always talk about, you know, the goal being a special moment. But, you know, we've seen you then run away, sliding into the muddy pitch and the rain-sodden pitch. I think Kerry Mayo caught you first. But it's that look on your face. And it's something that, as a Brighton fan, I think will stay with me forever, as to how much it means to everyone.
Yeah, yeah, even to me now, I'm welling up now. Just a release of emotion. We had to win the game. A massive point of us achieving our goal as professional footballers, but as a football club, still being alive, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so at the final whistle, you didn't even really get a chance to sort of like do a lap of honour, because I think the fans did it for you.
Yeah, it was like I didn't know what the fans might do to me. So I had to get off the pitch quite quickly. I think I made quite a few friends that day.
Well, at least you didn't have Lewis Dunk had happen to him. You got your shorts ripped off, yeah?
Yeah, that's what I was meaning. You know, you never know what's going to happen to you. But, we got off the pitch pretty quick. All the fans came on the pitch and we managed to get up into the main stand and share the delight with them, which was fantastic.
I mean, could you hear the Goldstone being dismantled from above you?
Yeah, I did a press interview afterwards, and it annoyed me. News of the World, they sort of was trying to put words into my mouth about...
What do you mean?
Well, they were saying, you know, they talked about the game for a little bit, and they were saying, look at this sort of unwanted violence at football grounds. And I said, what are you on about? You know, these people love this football ground. They're probably sat in that seat for 40 years and they want to take that seat away. Yeah. What's the issue? What is the issue? You know, people digging the pitch up. So what? So what? Someone's took centre spot. It's got nothing to do with violence. They were trying to sort of manipulate the fact.
No.
You know, and it was like, get shot. You know, go.
Yeah. If it's unwanted violence you want, mate, ask me that again.
Yeah. But it annoyed me in the fact because they just didn't get what it meant to everybody at the football club, the community. Yeah. It's their club, you know. It frustrated me a bit. Not that it took away my celebrations that night. So it didn't really...
Back you go. Do you remember? And if you do remember, you weren't there.
Yeah, well, exactly. I'll probably be somewhere in Brighton.
Good lad. Good lad. Which then leads us on to, and it's a game that, as someone who's been watching the Albion since 1978, and a fan for a couple of years before that, I would still say, and I think we'll never be beaten, as the most important game in the history of the club. Do you recall the build-up at all?
Yeah, we did it professionally again, as in we could do. We stopped over the night before, pre-match meal, and then as much preparation as we could going into the game. It was not a strange atmosphere, but it wasn't like playing at the Goldstone, because we'd won every game at the Goldstone, except bar one. I think we drew with Orient. Away from home, we were struggling to get a corner, let alone a point. And it was like a very surreal atmosphere. Very surreal. Wasn't as aggressive or energetic. There's a hint of, what's the word, unconfidence about us as well.
I recall having a conversation with Mark Ormerod a few years after that particular game. And I said, what were your memories of that day? And he said, we were doing warm-up and I couldn't catch a cold.
That was normal for Mark, though.
Oh, well, yeah. Fair enough. I didn't actually take that bit into consideration.
I think
for him as a goalkeeper, and a goalkeeper does always live in the spotlight like that.
Yeah.
The nerves. I mean, it would have been the same for Hereford, but the nerves would have been, well, as they say, the adrenaline goes brown, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it's you look at the consequence, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and the consequence, wow. Them or us.
Well,
weren't it? You know,
well, for them it was relegation, but for us, because we didn't have our own ground, we'd have had to been relegated three divisions. I think people don't necessarily realise that.
Yeah.
We'd have had to reset, put to probably pretty much below where Bedworth are now.
Yeah.
And can you imagine Brighton and Hove Albion, or a Phoenix AFC Brighton?
Yeah.
Yeah, all the way down there. No disrespect to Bedworth.
No.
But, you know, AFC Brighton. Yeah, but again, with no ground, because, you know, how long did it take to build our ground now? But that's another matter.
Yeah.
So you arrive at Hereford. And, you know, you've probably got film crews all over the place. I mean, this is the bottom of the fourth division. And yet there is this kind of, like I say, I'll use the word earlier, this bittersweet story of this club that was at the FA Cup final 14 years ago, about to be blown to smithereens if the thing doesn't go right today. And the it's a cautionary tale. It's now become a cautionary tale about bad ownership. But at the time, we're all living through this hell, aren't we? And for us, there's nowhere to go but, you know, collectively getting together and the players lifting the fans and the fans lifting the players in order to get the result we need.
Yeah, that togetherness was massive. You know, the goal the week before, and I think Hereford's result meant that we only needed a draw.
Yeah.
Which, again, with our away form, if we didn't need it to go there and win, I think possibly we would have struggled. So it was almost like all the stars have aligned and all we had to do was turn up.
Yeah.
It was easy. Good luck with that one. Yeah. But it just gave us that opportunity, didn't it? And again, I think because we'd had that, it's what you where you finish on that last game.
Yep.
Was still ringing in my head, you know, because that had been said for the last 4 or 5 months, which sort of was our mantra then. Our mantra was this game and we achieve our goal.
What do you remember of the game itself?
Not a lot. I remember Kerry Mayo scoring a good goal. and in some cases, I think that helped us. It sounds strange. I think we knew we had to score. And we knew, you know, it did give us a bit of opportunity to recover, reset and kick on. And obviously Robbie getting the goal. And then the final whistle was like, I still think I'm still waiting for it sometimes. It just seemed to never come, did it? You know?
Isn't that funny? Because I was watching the guy, I was there, and the of all the things I'm going to complain about is that the terrace at that away end was very shallow. So you couldn't actually see a great deal. And I was with my mate in the first half. And sorry, mate, but we were awful in that first half. I'm sure you probably know it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it was, as they say, they couldn't trap a bag of cement. And it wasn't, you know, and we're all looking at each other saying, can't do that again. We can't go through that again. And obviously second half, whatever's said at half time. And are you allowed to say what was happened, or is it still the case that what goes on in the dressing room stays in the dressing room?
I'd like to tell you, but I can't remember.
Very diplomatic. But yeah, I mean, second half, obviously we're a lot better. And like I said, Robbie gets that goal and becomes an instant hero and still is. But yeah, I just recall that we ended up sort of splitting up because I just wanted a better view. And yeah, we've scored with 28 minutes to go. And you're right, that 28 minutes seemed to take 3 months to pass. And yet my mate who was watching the game, and I'm thinking, lucky, lucky him. Because when the final whistle went, he went, ready? And I think he must have been the only Brighton fan in the ground to have thought that. Because
what did he want more?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But he was saying, yeah, it was quick. That's no, it wasn't, mate. That was torture.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But, yeah, so, you know, and you've seen the footage and, you know, there was no pitch invasion, but you must have just seen the limbs, certainly when we scored and then a final whistle. I mean, it was just, it must be a bit like being inside pure joy.
Yeah, just what a relief. You know, what a relief from the journey we've been on, you know, from the start of this interview. That's how far back this goes. So the journey we'd been on to get to that point and been so close to make or break, pure relief, pure joy, ecstasy, whatever you want to call it. It was just...
But still having to be respectful to your opposition who'd suffered the most indignant fate.
Yep, I can't. To be honest and not disrespectful, I can't remember much about them. I was so elated with us. Sure. That we were going round. But yeah, I would have hated to be in their position. You know, we'd hunted them down, won our home games, lost our away games, and just managed to pip them at the post. So horrible. You know, for them. They're probably not really recovered from that, have they?
No, but not really. No, I mean, I used to visit that area a lot. I used to go to the Hay on Wye Festival, which is not that far away, and meet up and see Hereford fans. And to this day, they haven't forgiven us.
Yeah, you know, I don't blame them, really.
Absolutely. I think that personally it's because the story that day was Brighton survived, and they were almost the forgotten half of it. And
yeah,
and I could understand their consternation about that. And yeah. and I don't blame them. And the irony is that we ended up as a club without a ground and they ended up a ground without a club.
Yeah.
You know, they reformed as a Phoenix club. Good for them. Managed to get back into the league. But yeah, it's a day that they've not forgotten. Do you recall, because for the life of me going up there, I cannot recall the journey going up there and I drove, but I do recall the journey going back. Does any of you recall the journey going home?
Well, I sat on the coach and it was almost quite quiet for a little while, you know. And then as we sort of started drinking a few, they got a little bit louder. But it was almost like I said, just that relief. And then, you know, once a few of the players then got on the coach, got a bit more livelier. And then I do remember the coach driving straight down. It was called the Paradox, and there was a couple of like bars up that road opposite the cinema. But we got the coach driver to drop us straight in the middle of Brighton, tracksuits on, straight out, and that was it. That was it. I think I got back in on Thursday or something.
And your name had changed to Susan.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, very, very late Sunday night I got back in. I think my missus was a little bit worried about me at times. So
is that a euphemism, worried?
Yes. I think she's forgiven me last week.
All right. She must have seen the headlines and realised what it meant for the town, though.
Oh, yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. She's good anyway, you know, but it was one of them where we've been through this journey together as a group of players, and this is the time to share the success. Although we call it success, we finished second from bottom.
But success is all relative, mate.
It is a massive success.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Listen, you know, it's a landmark season. In terms of how you thought of them then and how you look back on them now, give us your thoughts on that triumvirate of Archer, Bellotti and Stan, and I think probably mostly on Bellotti.
Just very disrespectful. Didn't really have a care about anyone else. Very selfish, thoughtless. No idea how to run a football club. The fact is, we all knew what was going on, but they didn't have the balls to come and tell us.
Yeah.
You know, not that you would have respect or liked the outcome, but if they could have had the balls and said, this is what's happening, we maybe could have got out of that situation a bit quicker. But the disrespect that they showed all of us was outrageous. Outrageous.
From your perspective, for the time that you signed from Exeter to the time you left us, what does Brighton and Hove Albion mean to you?
Oh, wow. But yeah, big part of my life. Massive experiences I went through. Met many people down there. I've got an affiliation with the fans. It was quite ironic, actually. I think you might just have to check your records on this. I think it was the 23rd of July, I think.
What was?
Brighton moved back to the Withdean. I actually packed up all my stuff in a Pickford's van and left Brighton on the same day. And I thought to myself, wow, that's really ironic that I'm leaving and they're coming back.
Did that hurt?
Yes. Yeah, it did hurt. But also it gave me a sense of pride that all the crap we'd been through from the dark days, it was almost like they're coming home, you know, which made me feel good.
But you'd have loved to have been part of that renaissance, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but I'd love to be part of the renaissance now playing for them.
Well, yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen either.
Yeah, we can all dream. You know, we can all dream.
Get the 7 shirt on again and get down the wing on my Zimmer frame.
Now, like I say, it's football fans have a long memory and we like to sort of commemorate things. And like I say, it is now 25 years since all this nonsense went on. The journey itself has been astonishing. But the club itself is putting on a bit of a do, which I understand you're going to be busy for.
Commitments again, yeah. Although I am coming down on the 7th of May, the club are doing a little bit for me on the 7th of May against the Man United.
Yep.
So I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, could you do something for us, Stuart, that day? Okay. Don't just be a guest of the club, be a guest of the fans. So come and say hello to us after the game, because where you're going to be isn't accessible to all the rest of the fans. So after the game, come and find us, would you?
I will do. I think it's been changed to an evening kickoff now, hasn't it?
Oh, crikey. Well, come and find us beforehand then.
Exactly. I'll let you buy me a beer, yeah?
You're on. Not a problem. I think, you know, by the time, for all the people that want to buy you a beer, you won't get to watch the match.
Yeah, and I'll get back to that stone and a half overweight again.
Listen, there's going to be a lot of people that want to thank you for everything you did for us, Stuart.
No, not really. I'm just so glad we all got together and made it happen. Thanks to all the fans. Thanks to you guys. And I look forward to seeing you on the 7th.
Absolutely. This has been the Albion Roar. I've been Alan Wares. I've been talking to Stuart Storer, and we'll catch up again soon. Thanks a lot. Bye.
I can watch my television talk. the matinee, they left without a trace. Ticket home.
Ticket home, I want a ticket home. Elvis Presley is the king. I was at his crowning. My life just flashed before my eyes. I must be drowning. In the skies while diving in champagne.